seats and bar stools.
Launching it deep downfield. Jump ball. Oh, man, Marvin Jones, how do you do? Oh, what a play. Stafford will move it to the right and throw complete to T.J. Jones. Touchdown, Detroit. Second and eight, here's Trubisky. Hansa pursuing, but he got rid of it. And interception. What a job by Slay. Big play, Darius Slay. Both feet down. Looked like a wide receiver. Interception. And the Lions will take over. Stafford back in the end zone. What a grab. Ebron goes up. Holds off. Touchdown, Detroit. And Trubisky throwing end zone. Intercepted. And Quandre Diggs, who's moved to safety, drops back. And the Lions come up with their second interception of this second half.
Ran the ball relatively well with 91 yards. Two things, you want to outrush your opponent and you would be somewhere in that 100-yard area. You know, I thought up front with our line, the guys hung in there, guys going in and out, and they found a way to pass protect us well enough and find some seams to run the ball. So that was key. But those turnovers were big, a difference maker in the game just in terms of being able to slow down a team that had a little momentum going at that time.
He got some work to do.
I think that's a fair question if he'll ever get it. I think he will, but he's got to keep working. I mean, those are the things that he's got to really fight against. One of the areas of the field where there's been some struggles, you know, but there's also been some improvement. So you want to keep, you know, it going that way. Today we took a step back. I apologize to our fans that we weren't able to do that, to get a home victory in our stadium. And I said that to our players, but hopefully this is the end of all of that. I hope it is. You know, I'm not going to make any guarantees that it is because you never know. It can't get much worse than this, true?
Here's a chest-high snap. Roethlisberger looks left, now looks right. Pumps, throws over the middle. It is caught by Jesse James, shy of the goal line. And then he bear crawls in for a touchdown. And Pittsburgh takes the lead with 28 seconds remaining.
This is a touchdown, no question. I'll tell you what, if this comes back, there is going to be an unhappy crowd here.
After reviewing the play, the receiver in the end zone did not survive the ground. It's an incomplete pass. It'll be Pittsburgh's ball, second down and 10 at the 10-yard line.
I don't have HD and all of that stuff, so it's really irrelevant how I feel about it, to be honest with you. It's not going to change the outcome of the game. I'm not going to cry over spilt milk and all of that crap and talk about replay. I ain't doing it.
Is it a catch in the bar?
Yes, it is.
Is it a catch in the flag football game?
Without a doubt.
Well, then it's a catch to us. But we don't make the rules. Jeff has been in, I've been in competition committee meetings. You talk about these things ad nauseum. You talk about them on end. And with this one, for sure, because it was something that was really important to me that we understood it, we still didn't. We talked about it for an hour, and you walked out, and you still said to yourself, I don't know what a catch is. I know what the rule is, and that's what the NFL cares more about. Let's make a rule. Whether the rule is right or wrong, but let's make a rule so we can say, you know what? When it looks like this, the rule says it's not a catch, no matter what you see. To me, that's a catch.
I think they got it right. I mean, the referees got it right. The ball moves. That's the way it is. For me, it's just difficult, especially on a goal line play. When a guy is catching it, his knees are down, and he reaches across the line. If I'm playing that play, I think that's a catch. We go through this every week. That type of play, to me, is a catch. It's frustrating that that play ends that way. But again, they did it right, but I don't like the rule. I think the way the rule is written needs to be changed so that they can execute it the right way.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Kushlin, I am very, very upset today.
You are.
And the reason I'm very, very upset today is I can't yell on the radio about everything that I'm upset about today.
And there are a few things, that's for sure.
Yesterday in the National Football League was a train wreck. Bad, bad day for the league on a day that should have been very, very good for the league because of a lot of very good football games, a lot of exciting outcomes, and a lot of really good play. And it all comes down to some, quite frankly, not the guys on the field when I say the rule makers, because they are not the rule makers. They're the rule enforcers, even though they are very often very terrible at it. But it's the rule makers, meaning the ones who live and operate in the National Football League front offices, particularly those involved with the competition committee. And that would mean some of the coaches as well, who take some of the blame for some of the messes we have yesterday. And the reason I can't yell about it as much as I want is because I've come down with a little bit of an, I don't know, over the weekend it got really cold and it just started messing with me. And it has just played havoc with my throat. So I'm going to try to do my best to stay a little low-key, a little bit understated during the program today so that my voice lasts for the entire 2 hours. You don't want, believe me, you don't want Cushlin to take over. I'll whisper if I have to, just to save you from having Cushlin take over for the next 2 hours. Nothing personal, Cush, by the way. Just
none taken.
And, of course, I'm kidding. I'm very, very lucky to have Jim Cushlin here for whenever I can't do the show because he does such an outstanding job. We got a lot of people to talk to today. Coming up here in just a couple of minutes, we're going to talk with Jeremy Reisman of the DetroitBadBoys.com website, which is, PrideOfDetroit.com. I just went to the Piston site, didn't I? DetroitBadBoys.com, that's the Lions site on SB Nation. Talk about the victory over the Bears. Matthew Stafford had himself a pretty decent day at 25 of 33 for 237 and a pair of scores. Mitch Trubisky did some very nice things for the Bears, except he also did three very bad things. The first-round draft pick, first quarterback taken, Mitch Trubisky, threw three interceptions. That's his big problem. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Lions win over the Bears, what it does, of course, to the playoff positioning within the National Football Conference, because that's really all it's about right now is, what do the Lions have to do and who do they have to root for in order to find a way to eke into the NFC playoffs. As it stands right now, the Lions would actually be in. If I'm reading the standings correctly, the Eagles on top at 12-2, Minnesota at 11-3, the Rams at 10-4. Then the Saints and Panthers also at 10-4, followed by the 8-5 Falcons for now, and then Detroit at 8-6. And that's the same record as Seattle and Dallas. So I don't know exactly what the tie-breaking rules are, and we're going to talk to Jeremy Reisman about that. But for now, the possibility would exist that the Lions could still do this. They're going to have to finish it out the way they've done the last couple of weeks. They're going to need a couple more wins. Cincinnati is terrible. Green Bay isn't terrible anymore now that Aaron Rodgers is back. But they lost to the red-hot Panthers yesterday, so they're also fighting for their playoff lives. They are at 7-7. So the possibilities are there, but the Lions did what they had to do yesterday to keep those possibilities alive, and that is get a very, very hard-fought win against the Chicago Bears, and they did so 20-10. And joining us now is Jeremy Reisman, PrideOfDetroit.com, with a little look at the Lions win and the rest of the National Football League. Jeremy, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you doing today?
Good, my man. Thanks for spending the time. I got a lot to cover with you here. I apologize for my voice. I'm trying to get through this sickness that just settled in over the weekend. But Jeremy, let's talk about a couple of things here regarding the victory against the Chicago Bears. Matthew Stafford threw a couple of touchdowns and, most importantly, avoided the mistakes that Mitch Trubisky did not avoid. Is it that simple? And it never really is, but how important was that to this game? Mitch Trubisky had a very, very nice game. The rookie is really developing, but he had three crucial interceptions. Matthew Stafford stayed turnover-free, and that's a good way to win a football game late in the season.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of the reason that the Lions were able to pick off Trubisky three times in that game is because they completely shut down their running game. I believe they only had about 45, 46 yards in the running game, and Trubisky threw it, I think, 45 times, which was 10 or 12 more passes than he's ever thrown in a game. And that's just not the Chicago Bears game. That's not how they like to run their offense. Not that they have been able to run their offense very successfully this year at all, but the way they do it typically is through the ground. And Lions obviously have that really, really good secondary that's able to capitalize on any rookie mistakes that Trubisky made, and he obviously made a couple on that game, whereas Matthew Stafford, kind of veteran guy, knew when to throw it away, knew when to take a sack when he had to take a sack, and played a pretty clean game from start to finish, really.
Excuse me. Yeah, he really did. And his quarterback rating for the game, too, is 115, and that's because in large part of those, it wasn't a ton of yards. 237 is pretty below average for Matthew Stafford's season and career, but he did stay turnover free through a couple of touchdowns. Give me your thoughts on the running game, because we've talked about this, you and I and Jim, about over the course of the last month or so, and about whether or not Jim Caldwell, Jim Bob Cooter need to commit more to the running game to balance things out, or just let Stafford turn Stafford loose. As a team, 91 rushing yards on 20 carries is 4.6 a carry, and that's a pretty good number, actually.
Yeah, and that was a big surprise to me. Almost as big as a surprise as the Lions being able to shut down the Bears' running game is how successful they were on the ground. It's interesting. I mean, the most interesting part about it is that Ameer Abdullah had one carry.
Right.
They did not rely on Ameer Abdullah. He only had 8 snaps in the entire game. So it kind of looks like the Lions are moving on, or at least temporarily moving on from Ameer Abdullah. That may change because Theo Riddick obviously suffered a wrist injury in that game. So we don't know his availability going forward. But it was an improved game, and it was with a patchwork offensive line, too. Joe Dahl made his first career start in that game at left guard, and it looked very good, especially at run blocking. They also had Corey Robinson in there at right tackle. It was a promising a change for this defense, or for this offense, and it was against a pretty good Bears defense, too. So it's a step in the right direction. I don't think anybody is ready to claim all the problems are fixed, and it's right now it's actually not really clear what changed. Maybe it was the personnel. Maybe Joe Dahl is this team's future left guard, but it's still way too early to tell.
What I really liked about the running game for me is the fact that it wasn't, all on, they had a 50-yard run, and then they supplemented it with a few other short runs. The longest run of the day was 12 yards by Riddick. Abdullah's, his one carry was for 8 yards, and Green had a 7-yarder. But the point is they were really churning it out to get that 4.6 per carry. And it kind of makes you wonder, considering they were having that success, if they couldn't have done a little bit more and run it more than 20 times.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. I think they probably would have liked to a little bit more in the second half. Obviously, missing Theo Riddick for most of the second half doesn't help. Also, the Bears just kind of had the ball forever in that second half. They had that drive in the fourth quarter that, for some reason, they thought it was a good idea to burn 7 minutes off the clock when they're down 3 possessions. But that's the one thing that I think we didn't see out of the Lions is an ability to run out the clock at the end of the game, an ability to when the defense knows you're going to try to run it, be able to run it. The Lions aren't anywhere near that right now. But I believe Theo Riddick had all 49 of his rushing yards in the first half, and that just kind of gives a sense of how successful they were at the beginning of that game. But the degree of difficulty goes up in the second half when you're playing with a lead and trying to run out the clock, and the Lions just aren't there with the running game yet.
Jeremy Reisman, PrideOfDetroit.com, joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. Jim Christian, go ahead.
Talk to me about, Jeremy, the defense in this game. I thought they were very good overall, forcing 3 interceptions, all 3 of the turnovers, 2 of them picked off by Darius Slay. By my count, only giving up 43 yards rushing to the Bears on this day, and a couple of sacks, so the pressure was there. To some degree, this was a decent game, I thought, a very good game from the defensive side of the ball, and that's something we haven't been able to say as much here in the last month or so.
Absolutely. I would argue that this might be their best defensive performance of the year. Basically, the Bears didn't score 8 points until the last quarter of that game. They had that field goal, but that was thanks to the Theo Riddick fumble at the end of the first half. Other than that, it was a clean game. And like I said before, it all started with stopping the Bears' run game, because that was their plan of attack. And they shut it down right away. And it resulted in a lot of early punts from the Bears. And then you mentioned the turnovers. The turnovers are always huge. But I think unlike in the early games of this year where the Lions kind of needed those turnovers to win these games, I don't think they necessarily needed them in this game. The Bears just weren't moving the ball all day. And aside from Quandre Diggs' pick in the end zone, I don't know if any of those interceptions really took points off the boards for the Bears. I think the defense was just overall really good. Jared Davis, the rookie linebacker, who I've kind of been hard on all year, had a really, really, really good game defending the run especially. And really all of the linebackers played a solid game, and that had been one of the weaker points of this Lions defense. Pass rush still needs some work. We still haven't seen Dwight Freedy get his first sack with the Lions. Ziggy didn't get a sack either, I don't believe, in this game. But if the Lions can stop the run, they're going to be able to contend with anybody, and that's what they showed, that they're at least capable of doing in spurts on Saturday.
Talking Lions football and a little bit more on the NFL as well with Jeremy Reisman, PrideOfDetroit.com. That's where you'll read him. PrideOfDetroit.com is part of SBNation.com. And, Jeremy, that's where you wrote about why the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are now Lions fans' favorite team. Tell us why.
Well, if the Lions are going to make the playoffs, they're going to have to basically jump one of two teams. They're one of really three teams. Either basically any of the three NFC South teams that are ahead of them, the Saints, the Panthers, and the Falcons. Mm-hmm. And the Buccaneers happen to play all three of those teams in the next three games. So, I mean, the gist of it is that the Lions, the easiest way that they can get in the playoffs is if the Falcons lose two of their next three, their first game coming tonight against the Buccaneers.
I don't see it.
That would push. Yeah, I don't really
see
it
anyway.
Either. But
that one.
That's a long shot. But the Falcons do play, I believe it's at New Orleans next week, and then against the Panthers the week after. And those are two very losable games for that team.
I would agree with that. The Panthers are red hot, no question about it. But you know, the Lions part of this, of course, is they're going to have to win.
Yes.
Is it possible to you, do you believe that, you know, that season ender at Ford Field against the Packers would be for the last playoff spot?
It's certainly possible, and it'll be interesting if the NFL tries to move that game to the Sunday night game. Obviously, the Packers probably won't have anything to play for. They're essentially at a 1% chance to make the playoffs right now after yesterday's loss. But, I mean, I guess it kind of depends really whether Aaron Rodgers plays in that game, because I don't think the national spotlight will turn Aaron Rodgers away just because he's a fun guy to watch. But, I mean, that's also a big factor in whether the Lions can win that game, because Aaron Rodgers kind of, I view him as kind of a stubborn guy, and if he can play, I think he'll push his way into the lineup in any way he can, even if there's nothing to play for. But yeah, I mean, essentially, there's a good chance that the season rides on that game for the Lions, and it'll be interesting to see how the Packers approach that game, because it'll have a huge effect on the NFC.
I didn't realize the Packers were at that 1%. I just know they're a game behind Detroit now, and if they win their next two, and if Detroit loses this one, and I don't know the whole Tampa Bay thing that you described, if that would impact Green Bay as well. So it certainly would. I think, yeah, Detroit has to win their last two games to even have a chance at this. I thought Green Bay might still have a chance as well in that same scenario, but I guess they would need a hell of a lot more help than Detroit would.
Yeah, I actually think the Packers are eliminated if the Bucs win tonight.
Oh, okay. So if Tampa wins, it helps Detroit, sure, and it kills Green Bay. So there you go. That's that kind of.
Or maybe it's the other way. Actually, it probably means it's probably the other way around.
I'm looking at the standings, guys. It would be the other way around, because the Falcons are 8-5, still have to play. Then you have Detroit, Seattle, Dallas at 8-6, Green Bay 7-7. So yeah, a Falcons win would make it a 2-game lead for over Green Bay anyway, with two to go.
Right, okay, and good. I believe they've beaten the Packers before, too. So, yeah, yep, that makes sense.
Thank you, Jim, for the clarification on that. Hey, Jeremy, just real quick, going around the league to the other big stories. Obviously, there were two officiating maneuvers yesterday that just, you know, have taken the, you know, the football fan world, if you will, by storm, if not the league itself. And, of course, we're talking about the Steelers, and we're talking about the Cowboys and the Raiders. And let's talk about index card gate, if you want to do that. I mean, honestly, first of all, I've never seen it before. Second of all, you only open yourself up, if you are that official, to huge, huge amounts of criticism, because if you just look at it from your angle and say, I see the point of the ball even with the post, therefore it's a first down, nobody can dispute you. All you can, it's my eyes. That's what I see, and that's it. Nobody else can, everybody can, because then it just becomes, well, I had a different angle than he did, the camera was at a different place than he was, blah, blah, blah. But this guy, who, according to a couple of reports I heard today, has a little bit of a penchant for, you know, for spotlight stealing. He likes the spotlight. He likes the cameras. You notice that smirk that he kind of gives as he looks into one of the cameras after he does the index card measurement, if you will. So he knows he's on TV, and he's liking every bit of this. And the double pump on the first down after that and everything else. But the thing, Jeremy, is, he slid that stupid car down between the pole and the ball never moved. If that ball was literally at the first down marker, it would literally, the card would touch the point of the ball. It doesn't. There's air there. There's space there. He moves it up and down in between the post and the ball, you know, the yard marker and the yard marker and the ball, which undoes his own theory that it was a first down. So why do you suppose he did this, and do you think this is something that the NFL is going to address with officials, that you don't do things like that to just open yourself up to second-guessing?
I'm still baffled by what happened. I've never seen anything like that. There's no way that was, like, what he was supposed to do, that that's the standard protocol for, for, I mean, he was winging it, right? He had to be winging it, which is awful. And there was a sky camera, like the cameras were all around him, and he should absolutely know better than to do something as strange and weird like that. Like, get down on your hands and knees and look a little bit closer if you're really that strained to see what, if it's the first down or not.
We've seen that before. We've seen officials do that.
Yeah. Yeah. What he did was completely unprofessional. It was hilarious, but it was still completely unprofessional. And, you know, if I was on the butt end of that call, then I would be irate, and rightfully so. But it's just unbelievable. And I would have to think he's getting a phone call from the league today if he hasn't already. He probably had
not voice only was messages it unprofessional, on I agree with you there, Jeremy and Jim, but it was inaccurate. Because, again, he stuck, first of all, the card was folded over twice, so it's twice as thick.
Right.
And he slides it down in there with all kinds of room to spare. The ball is not touching the card, and the card isn't touching the post at the same time. That means it's now it's short of the line to gain. It's first down going the other way. That's the weird part about it, is he goes through these theatrics to kind of just hog the spotlight a little bit, and does it and gets the thing wrong, because it's clear that the card went down in between there without touching anything.
It's one of the most bizarre things I've seen in terms of officiating, and this was a week full of bizarre plays, but I've never seen anything like that before, and I doubt we ever see anything like it again.
Do you believe, in staying in this game with the other big officiating call, just very briefly, do you believe that an offensive player who fumbles the ball out of bounds when he tries to reach for the end zone, as Derek Carr did in the fourth quarter of that game, do you believe that that should be a turnover? Should a fumble out of bounds or through the back of the end zone result in a turnover on the offensive team if the defense didn't do anything at all to secure possession of that football?
I'm going to say both to you. I think a ball that goes out of the back of the end zone should be a turnover, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
Because in any other place on the field in which you fumble the ball forward, 10 yards forward, the defense still has an opportunity to recover it. If that happens in the end zone, they don't have that opportunity just because the ball goes out of the end zone. That's not fair to them.
How's it not fair? If the ball is rolling in the end zone and none of them covers it, that's too bad. If the ball goes out of bounds on the sideline, the defense doesn't get it because they didn't recover it before it went out of bounds.
Right. Anywhere else in the field, if you fumble it forward, you can fumble it 80 yards forward and there's still an opportunity to recover it. That's why I say if it goes out of bounds in the end zone on the sideline, that should not be a turnover. Because,
part. I'm just going to disagree with you on the whole back of the end zone thing. Because, I mean, to me, the word turnover means possession was turned over. The ball was turned over from one team to the other team. The offense possesses the ball until the defense possesses the ball. If the defense doesn't possess the ball, you haven't turned it over. You have not made the ball yours now. It's just that it was lost possession by the offense, and nobody got it. So the offense keeps it because you didn't take it away from them. Now, I'm not saying they get the ball on the 1 yard line in a case like that, but I guess in the out of bounds one, I probably would. Wherever it was that Carr fumbled on that play as he dove for the pylon, you know, wherever he was and the ball went out of bounds like that, it should be spotted right there. The defense did not get the ball. I feel like the defense was rewarded for not doing anything positive on that play. It was a total mistake by Carr. Nobody jarred it from him. He just lost it as he dove. How does the defense get possession for that? That's one of those crazy rules I think they're going to have to deal with.
It's a bizarre rule. I'll admit as much. But to me, I know that it doesn't make a ton of logical sense, but I just like the way that it makes the red zone a little bit more intense. You know, it makes it a little more valuable. It puts more value on players taking care of the ball in the money zone, you know, where games are won and lost. That makes goal line stands more exciting. It makes, toe-tapping catches and reaching for the pylon like that. It makes those plays more exciting.
And recovering a fumble in the end zone. If your defense is doing something to stop the other team there, recover the fumble in the end zone. If you can't recover it and they don't recover it and it goes out of the back of the end zone, it's lost. You know, the down is over and we replay it from where we were. The team that possessed the ball didn't lose possession of the ball to the other team, and therefore, last thing, Jesse James. And I know the catch versus no catch is going to be the argument here, but the question is not really that. It's good rule or bad rule.
Oh, it's a horrible rule. I mean, Lions fans certainly are well familiar rule. They're the ones that started it back in 2010 with Calvin Johnson.
Right?
And we've been complaining about it since on deaf ears. And I don't think anything's going to happen because it happened with Dez Bryant a couple years ago in the playoffs. And if Dallas can't get that rule overturned or more clear, then I don't know if it's ever going
to
happen.
I just don't understand what the competition committee is doing. Do they care about fans watching their games or not? Because the fans from one end of this country to the other are all in agreement. That's stupid. That's a catch. That's a catch, and once the ball breaks the plane, I mean, if he was a running back and broke the plane, he could drop it and whatever you want to, and it's irrelevant once the plane is broken. But because he's on his knee and reaching over with his hands, but he's a receiver, suddenly that's not – I mean, if the entirety of the NFL fandom, aside from whether you hate the Steelers or hated the Cowboys in the Dez case or whatever – but if the rest of the world is saying that's the stupidest thing ever, you would think that the competition committee might want to go out of their way to say, you know what, the fans hate this. We better fix that stupid rule and let it be a catch. That's, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, make it a judgment call just like it's a hold. You know, holding is not is not reviewable. It's just, to my judgment, you know, if I'm the line judge, if I felt like that was a hold that impacted the pass rusher's ability to get to the ball or to the quarterback, that's a judgment call. Well, the judgment call of the official there on the field was he caught it, reached over, broke the plane. That's a completed pass and a touchdown. For the idiots in New York to sit up there like they're the eye of God in the sky, to me, is just it's just counterintuitive to good business, because you're killing your fan base when you make the league such a joke in that way.
And not to mention, guys, the proverbial cherry on top, we have a new phrase: did not survive the ground.
Yeah,
first time
that?
I heard it, I'm like, what the heck are you talking about?
If you thought complete the process of the catch was an annoying phrase, yeah, now you have survived the ground. Jeremy Reisman, read him and follow him at prideofdetroit.com. Great Lions coverage there. They got two more chances. They got to win them both and get some help as well. And read why Jeremy says Tampa Bay is their new best friend. Jeremy, thanks for the time, my friend. Happy holidays to you, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, and to you too.
You got it. All right, we're a little late here, so let's get wild, Kush.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
We got our man Scott Petrak going to talk about the Browns' 14th straight loss coming up on the other side of the bottom of the hour Sports Center. So let's get wild with this. For the second straight season, the hapless Browns have gone winless through their first 14 games of the campaign. Last year, of course, went 1-15 as they split their final two. These two Browns teams now join just three other teams in NFL history to lose their first 14 straight games or more. The other three, the 76 Bucks, the 2008 Lions, of course, who finished 0-16, and the NFL's only, which is the NFL's only 0-16 team, and the 1980 New Orleans Saints, who began 0-14, then split their last two just like the Browns. That's your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Bottom of the hour, local sports center coming your way, then Petrak right here on the Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
He's got some work to do. I think that's a fair question if he'll ever get it. I think he will, but he's got to keep working. I mean, those are the things that he's got to really fight against. One of the areas of the field where there's been some struggles, you know, but there's also been some improvement. So you want to keep, you know, it going that way. Today we took a step back.
Big step back for DeShone Kizer yesterday, but a big step forward today, because a lot of people thought that what Hugh Jackson said yesterday after the game, the Browns' 14th consecutive loss, their 29th in their last 30, and I can't even say that, and their 47th in their last 51. After that loss yesterday, there was a lot of speculation that Hugh Jackson, in trying to avoid the infamous 0-16, might make a quarterback change. But announced literally while we were talking to our friend Jeremy Reisman from prideofdetroit.com, we did get word that Hugh Jackson says that DeShone Kizer, Toledo's own, is up to the challenge and will start against the Bears in the penultimate game of this miserable season. Scott Petrak covers the Browns for brownszone.com. All of the numbers and news and notes and analysis that you could possibly ask for on the Browns, you'll find there at brownszone.com. Joining us now here on the Ticket. Hey, Scott, how are you?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, before we analyze yesterday, let's just analyze that news. Hugh Jackson has said he's going to stick with Kizer and give him this start against Chicago. He did say mid-season after the, you know, benching, and then he's back, and then he's benched, and then he's back. He did say he was going to finish out the season. So are you surprised after yesterday's performance that Hugh Jackson is going to stick with that?
I'm not, because listening to Hugh talk after the game, it felt to me less about how Deshaun played. I know he played really poorly, but it felt less about that and more about if Deshaun was too down in the dumps. You know, if he was not going to be able to shake off the bad performance. And Hugh put him today and obviously came to the decision that Deshaun was fine, resilient enough, would bounce back. And it's the right decision. You know, if the kid's gone this far, unless you thought he was broken, you know, physically or emotionally, you got to send him back out there for the last couple.
Scott, the belief, of course, is that the Browns are gonna draft a quarterback first, either Rosen or Darnold in all probability, which is going to be an end to Deshaun Kizer's starting career in Cleveland, I would imagine. Does he have a future as a starter in this league anywhere else, even after his rookie contract is over, signing someplace else or being traded? Or is he going to be considered damaged goods because he's had this many starts in his rookie year and has not automatically set the world on fire, which seems to be the, you know, the judgment zone these days.
Right.
You know, there was a time in the National Football League where Peyton Manning could throw 29 interceptions as a rookie and not be considered a bust. There was a time when Terry Bradshaw could struggle for his first 3 years in the NFL and still go on to be a Hall of Famer and not be considered a bust. But now it's like if you don't light it up in your first year, or, you know, in the case of somebody like Jared Goff, in your second year, you're just considered to be, you know, you're written off. That was just a bad investment and you're gone. So what do you see here if the Browns take a quarterback? What is Deshaun Kizer's future?
Yeah, it's interesting, Bob. It's so hard because you do get labeled so quickly these days. I will say this. I think in order for Deshaun to become a long-term starter somewhere, anywhere, it could be with the Browns, could be somewhere else. I'm not sure how he's going to get that chance. You know, could it come if there's an injury? Could it come if he gets traded to another team? Yeah, that might seem the most likely way it could happen now. But we've talked about it. I just think it's too early to write him off. There's too many good qualities in him. And I know he hasn't played well. And I know all about the turnovers. But I do think there's an upside. Now, the other problem Deshaun's fighting against is he was the number 52 pick in the draft, not the number one pick like Peyton Manning, or like Jared Goff, or even the number three pick like Blake Bortles. Mm-hmm. Those guys get longer just because of the investment. A number 52 pick, as silly as it may sound, can be thrown away.
Yeah, it's so funny. I feel really bad for this kid that a determination is being made now. And I just want to throw a couple of other guys out there. Peyton Manning, as I mentioned, you know, Deshaun Kizer has a 54% completion rating so far in his starts this season. And that's obviously very, very low for an NFL quarterback. But it's also only 2 points lower than what Manning's was in his entire rookie season. He threw 28 interceptions, did Peyton Manning, and had a 56% a 56% completion percentage. But that didn't last forever. You know, the next year he was up to 62. In fact, was it 62 for the next 3 years before 66, 67, 67, 67? And you say, well, this guy isn't Peyton Manning. Okay, very, very few are. I don't know if anybody else will be. But Matthew Stafford, the Lions quarterback, same thing. As a matter of fact, Deshaun Kizer is having a better rookie season than Matthew Stafford did in Detroit. Stafford threw 20 interceptions in 10 games. 20 interceptions in 10 games. And had a quarterback, a completion percentage of 53%, which is below Deshaun Kizer's. And look where he is now. He's a 66% guy, and he's the NFL's highest paid football player. So I just feel like guys can get better from 1 year to the next, exponentially better. They can be coached differently. They can be taught differently. They can learn from their mistakes when watching film and realizing when not to release the football. I just don't think the Browns should give up on this guy.
Well, those are great numbers, and I agree with you. The issue is, I think a bunch of different things are kind of working against Deshaun. Mm-hmm. And in order for a quarterback to live through a rookie season like the ones that you mentioned, you have to have the faith of someone, whether it's the coach, the GM, the owner, someone,
there has to be a significant investment, and there can't be a viable opportunity for an upgrade. And the Browns have that. I think that's the biggest thing working against Deshaun Kizer. When even you compare him to a guy like Blake Bortles, who has struggled, and you know, people would still argue whether or not he's a legitimate starting quarterback, even though he's got Jacksonville in the playoffs.
Yeah.
The Browns have $100 million, or will have approximately $100 million in salary cap space. They have the number one pick in the draft. So those are two prime opportunities to upgrade at the most important position. And, you know, the Browns are looking to take a significant jump in the win column, obviously. And that's the quickest way to do it. And even if Deshaun Kizer got better in year two, is he going to be good enough to be where Alex Smith is? Or where Eli Manning is, or whoever the Browns might be able to bring in, Case Keenum, or whoever that guy is, he probably wouldn't even be there if he improved. So then you're talking about even further down the road when Deshaun Kizer might be able to lead you to 9 or 10 wins. And I just don't think this organization, where it is, has that patience, especially when Deshaun hasn't given you enough reasons to believe he'll get there. He's given you some. And his body and his makeup and his intelligence tell you that he might be able to get there, but there's been too many instances where you go, nope, he's not the guy for you to for the team to have faith that he's going to get it turned around and get it turned around quickly enough.
Let's talk about Hugh Jackson. We're talking to Scott Petrak, who covers the Browns. He's a beat writer. Read his work and follow all of the Browns analysis and news and notes there at BrownsZone.com, BrownsZone.com. There were a couple of reports yesterday that there might be a bit of a tug of war between division rivals, that Cincinnati, now that Marvin Lewis is on his way out after 15 years and zero playoff victories, which is, by the way, just staggering that that can happen. That is just remarkable to me. But he's on his way out, and we know that he's got a great relationship, does Mike Brown, with Hugh Jackson, that even though Hugh is going to finish, you know, either one and 31 in 2 years, or 2-30, or 3-29, and I'm going to go ahead and guess the first one. That relationship between Brown and Jackson might still be strong enough to for there to be an interest there. Do you believe that Hugh Jackson will be the head coach for the Cleveland Browns next year, or will John Dorsey kind of use this little bit of an opening to say, you know what, maybe we should look for a longer-term solution?
I still believe Hugh Jackson will be in Cleveland next year. And I'm not ruling out that he winds up not being here. And I'm not even saying Cincinnati, right? Anything could happen. John Dorsey and Hugh bump heads over the last 2 weeks, or even after the season, and they decide, you know what, it's not going to work between us. They go 0-16. Jimmy Haslam can't stand the sight of the parade and says, I got to fire Hugh. Those things could happen. Cincinnati could make a run at Hugh. However, I do believe he comes back, and I think it's a pretty high probability that he comes back. I don't think owner Jimmy Haslam would have guaranteed Hugh's return at 0-12 without knowing the possibility of 0-16, and there was no need for him to guarantee it when he did. He could have easily said, we're going to let Hugh and John Dorsey get to know each other. We'll reevaluate at the end of the season, and he did not say that. So I expect Hugh to come back, and, you know, the Cincinnati, I know Mike Brown likes him. And you're right about that. But does Mike Brown like him enough to hire a guy that's 1-31 with the division rival? I just can't imagine Mike Brown likes him and trusts him enough to go out on a limb when there's going to be other, frankly, probably more qualified candidates. It just seems like far-fetched to me, even though I know people continue to bring it up as a possibility.
Yeah, it does to me, too. What I can see happening more likely is just John Dorsey saying, you know what, Jimmy said that. We have talked more, though, and we have decided to look in another, go in another direction. I'll never understand it if they do bring him back, Scott. I mean, I've gone over this with you before, so I hate to belabor the point. But like I said, it's never happened before in history for a team to go 1-31 in 2 years. Never. They've never gone 1-29 where they are right now. And I know he doesn't have a very good roster, and I know that John Dorsey made a point of blaming Sashi Brown on the way out the door for Sashi, saying he didn't get enough good players for Hugh Jackson. I get all of that, but you still don't go 1-31, ever. It just doesn't happen. It never has happened, and it shouldn't happen here with Hugh Jackson. You ought to be able to, you know, coach your players to play above their talent level. And that's what great coaches do. You play above your talent level. You get guys to go above and beyond a little bit, and you get yourself a win or two or three to kind of show how good this feels and how good this can be. And Hugh has been unable to do that, and I just will never understand if they keep him exactly what the argument for keeping him would be.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, Bob, and I can't argue with it because the record is what it is, and they had chances to win some games, and that falls on Hugh. We've talked about this. I blame most of the blame on the roster and think Hugh's hands have been largely tied by the roster. But, you know, I don't think we can pretend or assume this is the worst roster in the last decade in the NFL, and every other team has won games, right?
That's
except
right.
The 08 Lions.
That's
the only one that hasn't won it. So why hasn't Hugh? And plenty of blame falls on Hugh. He would probably shift a lot of that blame to the quarterback play, right? It's been awful quarterback play, league worst quarterback play. Now, Hugh's got something to do with that in the way he designed game plans and the way he called plays. So I grant you that. I would say this, and this, I'm not even sure this is a defense of Hugh. I think it might just be an explanation. I think Hugh was less concerned, and I'm going to say it, but I'm not even sure I believe it, but I think he was less concerned about maybe winning one game this year or two games, using a style like the Bears use, where you run it 45 times and your quarterback throws 12, and we're going to win a couple games, but we're still going to be bad. I think Hugh Jackson, part of his plan for the season was to try to build the offense that he envisions winning with a couple of years down the road, and Joe Thomas told me that once. And if that's your philosophy, then maybe you don't win now because you're going to put DeShone Kizer in position to make mistakes. And I'm not saying that's the right way to do it, and maybe he should have changed at some point in the season.
I'll
but
say
I
it's
just
not
think
the right way to do it, because look what it's doing to DeShone Kizer. Look what it's doing
right
to the kids. You know what I mean? You're throwing him into that situation saying, I'll sacrifice this guy's confident self-esteem and possibly career for now in order to put in the offense that I want that I think will bear fruit 2 years from now when there's a different quarterback there. That's indefensible to me.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, Bob. I just think... Yeah, and like I said, I can't necessarily defend you. I do think you would be markedly better with better talent. You know, I think most coaches would be, but I think you would be. And I think I like Hugh as a play caller, you know, but maybe I like Hugh as a play caller with the talent he likes. You know, I get the arguments against him this year. I really do. But he's trying to force DeShone Kizer into the quarterback he needs him to be. And maybe it's not good for DeShone Kizer, but maybe they figured out that DeShone Kizer can't be that guy, you know? And the other half of that is, if it breaks DeShone Kizer, then he's not the right guy. But I don't think it has broken him. And I think if you gave DeShone another 2 years, that he would be markedly improved. He's just not going to get that chance. Now, hopefully, they bring him back and he's your second or third quarterback next year. And if he's forced to play, that he's learned from all these experiences and he comes out on the other side. Because I do think that's in him. And I think it would be a shame if he doesn't get another chance here or somewhere else, because I feel he's different than all the other quarterbacks that have washed out in Cleveland. I think he has a much higher ceiling than the rest of those guys.
I would agree with that. Let me ask you one last question about this with the coaching situation for the 0-14, 1-29, and 4-47 Cleveland Browns. If Mike Pettine is the head coach this year, or if Pat Shurmur is the head coach this year, or if Romeo Crennel is the head coach this year, and I'm skipping over guys, obviously, Chudzinski, are they 0-14? Do any of those coaches have a chance to win a game or two games this year where Hugh Jackson has failed? Because to me, I feel like they would have. I feel like somebody else, even with this bad talent, would have won a game or two. What say you?
Yeah, I would say yes, because we saw them win games, you know, not a ton of games, but we did see them win games.
With
crappy rosters, right, but probably not as crappy. I mean, I guess that's what it boils down to. And, you know, when you go big scheme of things, does it matter if they win zero games or one game versus three or four? Probably not. You know, you're still bad. You're not close to getting to the playoffs. I think from a psyche standpoint, 0-16 would be awful, which is why they're trying to avoid that. It's hard to argue because those guys won games and Hugh Jackson didn't. I also think the team has gotten a little bit unlucky. You know, they have been in a couple games and haven't been able to finish them out, and they deserve all the blame. but it's not ludicrous to think that this team could have two wins already and still be awful, but we wouldn't be talking about 0-14.
I think that's fair to say. Last thing, Scott, if 0-16 happens, will you be covering the parade for BrownsZone.com?
I don't see how I get out of that.
You're going to look for a way, though, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I don't like parades. I never have. Second of all, I think it's a silly idea. You know, God bless them for raising money for, you know, charity. I just really don't get the point of it.
You know, I do. And it's one of the reasons I rip them on the radio, and not that anybody cares in Cleveland what I'm doing here in Toledo, but I want them to feel every inch of the shame that comes with 0-16. I want Haslam to not be able to look away from it, because it's going to be on TV, and it's going to be covered in the papers, and it's going to be all over the web. I want them to feel every inch of it and the pain that the Browns fans feel. And I want them to know how shameful it is. I want them to know they're going down in history as one of only two teams ever to be so incompetent. And in fact, this team is far worse than the 0-16 Lions because, as I say, with the two-year numbers being what they are. I want them to know that the fans hate it and that they're out there by the thousands mocking them publicly. You know what it is? You maybe from your college days, remember the old walk of shame? It's the ultimate walk of shame for Browns fans mocking the Cleveland Browns 0-16 team, the opposite of a championship parade, and I want them to feel that and to know that's how Browns fans feel.
Yeah, I mean, I see that. You would hope that they would know that already. You know, I mean, 4-47 should be all Jimmy Haslam needs to appreciate that. Looking at all the empty orange seats in the stadium should be enough. I mean, if this drives the point home, but here's the thing. I mean, what's he going to do? I mean, is he going to have an epiphany? So if it's great, the fans want to vent. To me, you're bringing some embarrassment upon your team and your city, and maybe they deserve all that, and that's fine. I'm just not sure what kind of impact it would have. I guess that's the bottom line.
Yeah, and maybe none. I don't know. But nothing like this has ever been done before, and I think maybe that will just kind of, increase the sense of urgency, if you will. Because to me, what it would do is it would make me reevaluate everything. It would make me reevaluate the decision to keep the decision makers in the front office on, except for Sashi Brown, to keep the coaching staff in place, including Hugh Jackson. To me, that's what it would make me do, is this really... You know, look what we have been reduced to. Look what our fan base has been reduced to. For God's sakes, this is shameful. And who knows, maybe it'll embarrass them enough to sell the damn team. Scott Petrak, great work as always, my friend. Thank you. Keep up the good work on BrownsZone.com. I will not talk to you before next Monday, which is Christmas. So I wish you Merry Christmas, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Hey, same to you, Bob. Thanks, bud.
Thank you, Scott. Scott Petrak joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. We'll get a timeout now for the top of the hour Sports Center coming your way. And after that, Paul Keels shifts gears for us quite rapidly, as a matter of fact, as we talk Ohio State basketball. Do that coming up at about 4:10. And then I want to get into your phone calls about all of these things in the NFL yesterday, the rules, how they are written with respect to a catch, how they are written with respect to loss of possession when you fumble out of bounds in the end zone. And also the index card nonsense. The NFL, if you ask me, is just opening up a can of worms that they're going to wish that they had never done. Or maybe we'll call it a Pandora's box. And I think that's going to come back to bite them. But I want to get your thoughts on it, too, next hour when we come right back on the Ticket.
Here's a chest-high snap. Roethlisberger looks left, now looks right, pumps, throws over the middle. It is caught by Jesse James, shy of the goal line, and then he bear crawls in for a touchdown. And Pittsburgh takes the lead with 28 seconds remaining.
This is a touchdown, no question. I'll tell you what, if this comes back, there is going to be an unhappy crowd here.
After reviewing the play, the receiver in the end zone did not survive the ground. It's an incomplete pass. It'll be Pittsburgh's ball, second down and 10 at the 10-yard line.
I don't have HD and all of that stuff, so it's really irrelevant how I feel about it, to be honest with you. It's not going to change the outcome of the game. I'm not going to cry over spilt milk and all of that crap and talk about replay. I ain't doing it.
Is it a catch in the bar?
Yes, it is.
Is it a catch in the flag football game?
Without a doubt.
Well, then it's a catch to us. But we don't make the rules. Jeff has been in competition committee meetings. You talk about these things ad nauseum. You talk about them on end. And with this one, for sure, because it was something that was really important to me that we understood it, we still didn't. We talked about it for an hour, and you walked out, and you still said to yourself, I don't know what a catch is. I know what the rule is. And that's what the NFL cares more about. Let's make a rule. Whether the rule is right or wrong, but let's make a rule so we can say, you know what? When it looks like this, the rule says it's not a catch, no matter what you see. To me, that's a catch.
I think they got it right. I mean, the referees got it right. The ball moves. That's the way it is. For me, it's just difficult, especially on a goal line play when a guy is catching it, his knees are down, and he reaches across the line. If I'm playing that play, I think that's a catch. We go through this every week. That type of play, to me, is a catch. It's frustrating that that play ends that way. But again, they did it right, but I don't like the rule. I think the way the rule is written needs to be changed so that they can execute it the right way.
I just can't say enough about JT and Kata, and hopefully it continues. Their leadership, their ability to get us ready to play. You know, we've got a lot of things we've got to work on and fix, but the biggest thing for me is what's our mindset in these types of, from game to game, and it's been pretty good, so we just got to keep it up.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Rolling onward. It's 13 minutes after 4. Thanks so much for joining us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks to my guest in the first hour of the program, Jeremy Reisman, PrideOfDetroit.com, talking about the Lions' win, and Scott Petrak talking about the Browns' continuing and piling and mounting losses. Buckeyes. How about that? Ohio State Buckeyes came back and got a win. They had a little bit of a tough stretch in the middle of the season. They now have won their early part of the season. What am I saying? Now four straight victories, including an 80-67 win on Saturday over Appalachian State. And joining us now to talk about it is the man who called that game and the man who was apparently playing with matches up in the broadcast booth, Paul Keels, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hey, Paul, how are you?
I'm good, Bob. How you doing?
I'm good. What are you doing up there? Smoking in the boys' room, setting off fire alarms and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, you're the second person that accused me, a non-smoker, of doing that. That was a first in, you know, almost 40 years in this business. I've never experienced something like that. And, you know, for those of your listeners who may not know what we're talking about, the game's going on early in the second half. A foul was called. Ohio State fouled one of the Appalachian State players. And all of a sudden, this fire alarm type of sound comes out of the scorer's table and starts lighting up. Chris Holtman is standing in front of the scorer's table. And he turns around and looks, and like many of us, we figured it was maybe just a malfunction at the scorer's table. But then
Maybe that's a flagrant foul alarm.
Yeah, maybe. But then a pre-recorded announcement comes on saying there's an emergency alert asking everybody to leave the building. Well, in essence, what they did is they wanted everybody to leave the seating area to go to the concourse. And hats off to the fans, because they did it very orderly with the help of the ushers, who handled things very well. We stayed on the air, by the way. We did not leave. Our executive producer, Skip Mosick, was kind of in contact with people while we were filling the airways, just kind of keeping up what was going on. And it ended up, it was an exhaust fan that malfunctioned in one of the concession stands, and it set a fire alarm off. The good news was, though, that, I mean, the most important news, there wasn't any problem or any concern.
Right.
But it seemed most of the crowd came back. If many left, it wasn't noticeable. The teams both went to their locker rooms, the officials went to their dressing room, and the game kind of went on. So it was very unusual night, Bob.
Well, at least they didn't make everybody go outside. Because, you know, usually when there's events like that, you know, if there is a fire alarm that goes off, whether it's a drill or, you know, an actual, you know, situation like this, they make you leave the building. So they at least let you guys stay in and broadcast, and the players didn't have to leave and go out into the cold either. They could stay in their locker rooms, right?
Yeah, I know the young man who was doing the game for Appalachian State was sitting next to us. He stayed on the air. TV apparently went away, so they weren't as brave. but there had been an indication early on, apparently, that it wasn't something, I mean, you know, goodness gracious, you hate to say it, but in this day and age, you just don't know with all the things that happen in the world what it could be.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Paul, because go ahead and give me more detail on what you said there when you said it was a pre-recorded message came on saying there was what, an alert in the building?
An emergency alarm.
Emergency alarm. So that could mean anything from fire to, you know, sadly in 2017 to an attack or anything like that.
Right, and it wasn't being made by the regular PA announcer. It was something pre-recorded, so obviously it must be programmed in. But, you know, hats off also to the game management people at Ohio State and everybody, and getting everything restarted. you know, the teams came back out. They had, I think about 2 minutes to warm up and get ready. And, and you worried because Ohio State had some pretty good momentum going at the time of the stoppage. But, yeah, it's just one of those strange things. And one of the early thoughts that came to my mind in the midst of it all, thank goodness it wasn't in the football stadium with that many people.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. What are you going to do with 110,000 people?
Yeah. Yeah. But fortunately all turned out good.
Well, were you nervous as you continued to broadcast there, or you said your producer was feeding you information? You know, did they get it to you that hey, this is just a an alarm situation because of a fan, not really an actual fire or anything like that? Or
we didn't find out exactly what it was until after the game had resumed. But sure, very nervous. I mean, Ron Stokes and I and Skip Mossick, our producer, we were kind of gathering our stuff together there at our table on our perch, looking down, as if because we were thinking they were going to tell us that we had to go and. Was even mentioning on the air to, our flagship station and to our affiliates, be ready because we might be going next. But we kind of had gotten the indication through Skip and everybody else all along that they think they've zeroed in on what it is. I trust Skip Mossick, obviously, with my life when it comes to something like that.
Sure.
So but to answer your question, Bob, yes, nervous because you just don't know.
But we do know that it was an exhaust fan in a concessions area, and not the red hot shooting of Jayshon Tate that caused the fire alarm to go off. Jayshon with 19 points, Kata Bates the up with 18 points, and in a very, very well rounded Buckeye win. Tell us about it.
Well, and as Chris Holtman has said a number of times, Bob, those two have to be at their best pretty much every night for this team to win. I think Cam Williams got into double figures with 11. Also, that when Cam's hitting shots and not necessarily threes. He's, gotten better at pulling up inside the three-point line to shoot. And, Caleb Weston, even though he fouled out, he was doing his usual thing down low. And I think, we're starting to see some really significant signs of that young man growing up as a post player. So it was a very good all-around night against an Appalachian State team who really had a couple of guys that were playing on quite a role. One of them, a guy from Delaware, Ohio, right here in the area, who had had a career high their previous game at Akron. In Griffin Kenney, but Ohio State was really able to shut him down and do a very good defensive job on the other threats that Appalachian State had.
Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, talking a little Buckeye basketball. Jim Cushing's with us too. Paul, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, and in this kind of game, even second half between the two, 40-40, so not a whole bunch of production, only 8 total points coming from the bench. Obviously, it wasn't needed as much in this particular game when you beat this team by 13, but talk to me about the bench's lack of numbers in this game, if you will.
Well, I think that, Jim, speaks to the fact that, first off, Micah Potter tried to play for the first time in a while, and he could only give him a few minutes because of his high ankle sprain. Musa Diallo is a 17-year-old freshman who was reclassified to graduate high school early, and I don't know if you want to say he's hit a wall, but the upgrade in competition seems to have caught up to him a little bit. Andrew Dockage isn't somebody generally they're going to look to score. So, I think there's some of those situations. And Andre Wesson really has kind of struggled to score this year for the entire year. So it's a little bit of that. But one of the things I think you may see, and we've seen it a little bit here early, Chris Holtman is a guy that he's not necessarily going to stay pat with the same lineup all the time. And, we saw it 2 years ago, I guess it was, the threat that Cam Williams was coming off the bench as a scorer and a threat. And, it wouldn't be surprising at some point in time if that occurs. I think certainly Musa Diallo has shown he's got the ability to score and give this team something. So, yes, it's a concern. I think Kyle Young's a guy that prior to his ankle injury, he had, I think it was 8 points he had against Michigan. He's a guy that can give you some of that, especially off of offensive rebounds. But no question it's a concern. And I think, Jim, that also ties into the fact that for everything that Ohio State's doing well, shooting three-pointers is not one of them.
So, Paul, looking forward now, 2 games to go before Christmas and the little break that comes with that. It's the Citadel tomorrow, and that'll be at home. And then, UNC is also at home. Quite a couple of different opponents there when you talk about a 5-6 Citadel team and then North Carolina, number 5 in the country.
Well, Citadel will be an interesting challenge because they average almost 90 points a game. Their coach, Bob, is a guy by the name of Duger Balcom, but he was the head coach at VMI for 10 years. And he brought a couple of his VMI teams here into Columbus to play some of Thad Matta's teams. And they push it as fast as they can. They try to score as fast as they can. Their offense has been described as loot and shoot. They really, really just kind of push the pace very aggressively. But they've also done a very good job forcing, I think it's an average of about 21 turnovers a game. So it's one of those, I'm sure that it's had Chris Holt and Payson Carpet in his living room. One of those that most of us don't really think that much of it with a name, but if you're familiar with what Duggar Baucom has done as a head coach, that's a game that can give coaches fits. You hope that size and athleticism and experience will help. And then, yeah, then North Carolina, Saturday afternoon down in New Orleans. This is the continuation of that CBS Sports Classic with Ohio State, Carolina, Kentucky, and UCLA. And, you know, you don't have to say much because you know what North Carolina is all about, even though they had to struggle yesterday to win at Tennessee. But, you know, that's going to be another one of those, like those games in Portland, that'll show us what they've got. Then, you know, then a home non-conference game against Miami, Ohio, a week from Saturday before they resume Big Ten play. So it has been kind of crazy the way the schedule's been disjointed, but, you know, we talked about that before.
How much of a test do you think that'll be for Coach Holtman as far as the New Orleans game against UNC? I mean, I'm not saying you have to go out there and win it, but you certainly don't want to go out there and get your doors blown off either. It's a very good basketball team. What are you expecting from that game? And what do you think coach is expecting from that game?
Well, you know, Bob, I think what you're thinking is probably what Chris Holtman's going to say, is to see them go out there and compete. You know, Chris isn't going to say they don't think they have a chance at winning. If you remember 2 years ago in this same event, they played Kentucky up in Brooklyn and surprised everybody by beating Kentucky. So, you know, that's where if shots fall, they can make it interesting. If somebody gets in foul trouble for the opposition, that makes it interesting. But, you know, I realistically, I know people think that's a game that Ohio State probably can't win, and understandably so. But what you want to see them do is go out there and compete against the highest level and give you an idea what it's going to be like where they have to compete on the road against tough Big Ten teams.
No question about it. So Paul Keels will have the call tomorrow, of course, in the game against the Citadel. Then again, looking ahead to the New Orleans game against North Carolina. And then it's Christmas time. And, Paul, we won't talk to you again before Christmas. So I want to wish you and your family a very happy holiday and a Merry Christmas. And we'll look forward to talking to you sometime next week.
Well, thanks, Bob, and same to you and Jim and your families.
Thank you so much, sir. Have a great one.
All right, guys. Take care.
Paul Keels, the great voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. We're a good guy. Great broadcaster and even better person, I think it's safe to say. Well, that was a crazy thing, by the way. I didn't watch it live or listen to it live, the Appalachian State Ohio State game. So I can only imagine how it was, you know, for Paul and for other people who are still in the building.
Right.
When you get that automatic alert, you know, automatic recording that must be connected to the alarm, you know, the fire alarm, which is just saying there is an emergency alarm activated in the building, and not telling you that it's a fire drill or it's a fire alarm or that it's, you know, what it is. Because if you just hear whoop, whoop, and I'm mimicking the sound, of course, but whatever it is, you know, it could be a shooter in the building. It could be some sort of other attack. I mean, we've just sadly kind of become, you know, accustomed to these kinds of things in large places, large venues with a lot of people. You know, concerts have been targeted and games and all sorts of things like that. So that must have been pretty pretty scary there for a few, at least for Paul, because they said that everybody was evacuated.
There you go.
Evacuated for only about 9 minutes before they let the fans come back in. And then the game, though, didn't restart for about another 16 minutes after that, I think. So quite a bit of a delay there, and there must have been some scary moments, or, you know, for at least a moment or two.
Yeah, it certainly would have been. You don't know what's really going on, and then once it starts settling down, then you wonder, yeah, how much is a delay of this length at halftime, really extending the halftime, you know, going to affect things? It didn't obviously affect, I think, a ton, though Appalachian State did play a little bit better in the second half. It was 40-40 between the two, so that's why it was only a 13-point game. But, yeah, certainly and definitely an odd thing you certainly don't expect when you go to the arena to watch a game.
And the second half had started. This wasn't exactly halftime.
That's right, yeah.
It was very early, though. It was about 17 minutes to go in the second half. So it was, they'd been playing for about 2.5 minutes of the second half when this whole thing happened before they had to go in. So, what was interesting about it is Paul said the Buckeyes were on quite a run before that in the first start of the second half. They were playing very well and extended their lead to like 46-33, and then they came out of that and it was 6 quick points from App State, right, cutting it to a 9-point lead. So. Obviously, they righted the ship. But, okay, Kush, we're going to get a bottom-of-the-hour local sports center coming here. And on the way into doing that, because on the other side of that, I want to open up phone lines. All right, be ready to dial 866-240-1065. What do you want the NFL to do about the catch rule? And do you agree with the turnover, change of possession rule when somebody like Derek Carr fumbles in the end zone and it goes either out of bounds on the side or out through the back of the end zone? Do you believe that it's right to reward the defense giving them the ball when they did not turn over the ball? They did not take the ball from the other team. Those are two of the really strange rules-oriented situations in NFL games yesterday. Obviously, the Jesse James catch in the highly anticipated, and it did not disappoint, by the way. The Steelers and Patriots game did not disappoint. It was everything it was supposed to be, except for an honest victory. Because the NFL, you know, they may or may not, and I've got thoughts on whether or not, even though the rule stinks, most people are saying, well, the rule stinks, but the application of it was correct here, that the referees did their jobs. I've got a question as to whether even that part is true. Not only does the rule suck, I think the referee still botched the call. And I'll explain what I mean by that after we get to the bottom of the hour local sports center. And as they say on the way to that, Kush, let's do a little hockey. How about this? On December 27th, a couple of days after Christmas, that's a Wednesday, I believe.
Yes, that is a Wednesday.
The Toledo Walleye will take on the Indy Fuel at the Huntington Center, and I've got a pair of tickets right now. So what do you say we give those away to caller number six? Caller number six, dial 866-240-1065, and we'll set you up with the hockey tickets, and we'll come back after the Sports Center and talk about the NFL's rulemakers and when they're going to do something to fix their broken game. That coming up right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Again, so right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Back indeed. It is 4:38, 22 minutes of outstanding awesome left for you before drive time comes your way with Mr. Miller right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. All right, so Kush, we got to dive into this because I've heard every opinion that there is to hear by way of Twitter, by way of Facebook, by way of broadcast, columnists, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody's got their thoughts on what happened yesterday in those two events. But particularly, I want to focus on the Steelers game against the Patriots. And it was clearly the game of the year. I don't think anybody would doubt that or disagree with that. It was the game of the year in the NFL. Two marquee teams, one 11-2, the other 10-3. Probably playing for home field advantage in the playoffs. And if things go according to form, they will meet again in the AFC Championship game. And now, of course, again, it will be in Foxborough rather than in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And a huge, huge play in the game, of course, not the only play. I, for one, will not stop or will not allow people to get away with the they cost, you know, this team a game because they favor the Patriots. The NFL is in it to fix it for the Patriots, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, we know that can't be true anymore after what they did to the Patriots during Deflategate. Second of all, there were plenty of plays that the Steelers could have made to win this game despite the terrible call or the terrible reversal. The call was fine. The reversal from New York was the problem on the Jesse James would-be, could-be touchdown. Particularly prior, did you watch all of the game, Jim? Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, yes. No, I didn't watch it live, but I have seen it many a time since.
Prior to that last possession for the Steelers, there the Patriots, of course, had to come back with about 2 minutes to go.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Brady was down five and just needed to get in, and you know it, what he has done so masterfully so many times, it was no big deal, no surprise, except for the fact that on second down, on that drive, a tipped ball went literally right through the arms of Sean Davis. I mean, a game-sealing, game-clinching interception that your child could have caught, Jim.
Right.
I mean, seriously, it was one of those. And he had to reach behind him a little bit, but I mean, he just let the ball go right through both of his hands. So make that play,
yeah.
The rest of this is nothing but noise.
It's a moot
the rest
point,
of this
yeah.
isn't even noise because it's not an issue. It didn't happen. The Steelers would not have needed to come back. They wouldn't have needed that amazing catch and run by Juju Smith-Schuster, who weaved his way all the way down to the New England 10-yard line, setting up that pass to Jesse James. So all of this, you know, and then, of course, we know what happened after the incompletion, what was ruled to be an incompletion, as Roethlisberger does a little bit of a fake pump spike and then tries to force one to Eli Rogers, intercepted, game over. So we know. I'm not going to be that guy that allows people to say, well, the refs cost my team a game.
Because
right. There were many chances to win that game outside of this terrible referee's call. All right? I want to be clear about that. Having said that, I want to talk about this in a bigger picture because of what it means to the National Football League. Because NFL fans, quite frankly, are getting sick and tired of the NFL ignoring what is obvious and plain to the rest of our eyes. You know, there's something about knowing your audience. There's something about understanding, giving the customer what they want in business. You know, and you wonder why the NFL is losing money, and they are. They're losing money hand over fist in a lot of ways. Ratings are down, attendance is down, et cetera, et cetera. I think a lot of it has to do with the protesting players and middle America getting really sick and tired of the attacks on our police officers and our military, et cetera, et cetera. That has something to do with it. I think, you know, the Thursday football and a little bit of the oversaturation might have something to do with it. Remember, why are diamonds so valuable? Because of their scarcity. And instead of smothering us with so much football, I think they're making a mistake. But I think the other part is people are sick and tired of suspensions for legal blocks. They're tired of suspensions and fines for good hard hits. They're tired of redefining what a catch is. And that, of course, is where we are after last night's or yesterday late evening's game in Pittsburgh. If Joe Schmo, and I think you played this, Jim, in the montage from Ryan Clark. I think it was Ryan Clark. Can see from his spot on his stool at the bar that's a catch. The rest of, you know, the 150 million viewers in America can tell that's a catch. And the league is looking at you, its customer, and saying, no, that's not a catch. The customers are leaving the place. They're sick of it. They're sick of the inconsistency. They're sick of being told that their lying eyes are just that. That it's a lie. You didn't really see that. You didn't see a catch. You just think you did because you didn't survive the ground. It's just so
that's
much.
That's my main takeaway from this whole thing. I'll get to that in a second.
And this is going to hurt the game. Let's listen to the play one more time here.
Roethlisberger looks left, now looks right, pumps, goes over the middle. It is caught by Jesse James, shy of the goal line, and then he bear crawls in for a touchdown. And Pittsburgh takes the lead with 28 seconds remaining.
This is a touchdown, no question. I'll tell you what, if this comes back, there is going to be an unhappy crowd here.
Well, guess what? There was an unhappy crowd there because
after reviewing the play, the receiver in the end zone did not survive the ground. It's an incomplete pass.
Did not survive the ground. It's an incomplete pass.
Is it a catch in the bar?
Yes, it is.
Is it a catch in the flag football game?
Without a doubt.
Well, then it's a catch to us. But we don't make the rules. Jeff has been in, I've been in competition committee meetings. You talk about these things ad nauseum. You talk about them on end. And with this one, for sure, because it was something that was really important to me that we understood it, we still didn't. We talked about it for an hour, and you walked out, and you still said to yourself, I don't know what a catch is. I know what the rule is. And that's what the NFL cares more about. Let's make a rule. Whether the rule is right or wrong, but let's make a rule so we can say, you know what? When it looks like this, the rule says it's not a catch, no matter what you see. To me, that's a catch.
I think they.
And that's exactly the point. the point that Ryan Clark just made there. If it's a catch to me at home, and if it's a catch to anybody who has ever played the game before or just watched it for a very long period of time, then they need to make a rule that says that's a catch. They've got to stop saying no, 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 no. You don't know what it means to catch a football. Only we do. Only we on the competition committee do we know what a catch is. Only we in the officials' offices do we know what a catch is. You silly people who have been watching football for the last 45 years, you don't know anything. We'll tell you what a catch is and what a catch isn't. And that, to me, is a big, big part of this problem. Number one, the inconsistency in with which this rule is applied. Number two, the incredible inconsistency with which the plane of the goal line is treated. Now, I have long said I absolutely hate the ridiculousness of the plane of the goal line. For if there is a plane, an invisible plane extending skyward from the goal line, that once that is broken, then it is a touchdown. If the ball even touches that, if the point of the ball touches that invisible plane, then it's a touchdown. Well, then that same plane would exist on the sidelines. And if the ball even touches the out-of-bounds sideline plane, well, then now you can't catch it. That would be an incomplete pass because it's now a dead ball, just as it is when it crosses the dead, the plane of the goal line, it becomes dead. I hate that rule because to me, if I understand the history of the game properly, a touchdown used to mean you have to be into the end zone and touch the ball down into the end zone. That's what it used to mean. Touchdown meant you get you and with possession of the ball are in the end zone, and you are touching it down. I don't like this plain nonsense. To me, the ball should have to be fully across the goal line in the possession of the player. But be that as it may, the rule does exist that the plane of the goal line is all that has to be breached.
Right.
Now, if Jesse James had taken that ball on an end around, on a reverse, and gotten to the 1 yard line and dropped to his knee, still not touched by another player, holding the ball with two hands in full and total control and possession of it, which he was after this catch, had he been running that ball and fallen to his knee and then extended the ball over the goal line, the plane of the goal line, and then slammed it or touched it onto the ground that he did, at which point it popped up and moved a little bit, it wouldn't matter a lick to the league, because the rule would say everything after it touched the plane, the indivisible plane of the goal line, is irrelevant. It's a dead ball the moment the plane is breached. And so, therefore, it's a touchdown. It doesn't matter if he fumbles it, if it doesn't matter what happens after that plane is breached while it's in his full possession. So if that's the case when he's a runner, then how and why can it not be the case when he is a catcher? Because he has completely and clearly caught the ball. It is in his possession. It is locked between his two big hands as he goes down to his knee and then realizes how close he is to the goal line, realizes he hasn't been touched yet, and therefore extends over, breaking that plane and scoring what should have been the go-ahead touchdown. For them to say that no, he was down, but he wasn't really all the way down. His whole body had to be down, not just his knee as he goes to the ground, and he still has to maintain total control of the ball while he's laying flat on the ground, is telling you and me and every fan who watches football that we're morons, that we're stupid, that we don't know what a catch is and what one isn't. And clearly, as a lot of NFL players are saying at the same time now, we do. I mean, even other players who have no dog in that fight, they don't root for the Patriots, they don't root for the Steelers, they root for their own team on which they play. But they're saying this has got to stop. The Dez Bryant catch, this catch, obviously it goes back to 2010 and Calvin, the way this has gone. Redefining what it means to catch a ball simply has to stop, Jim, or they're going to drive good, loyal fans away because of the insult of it all. It is very insulting for them to tell me that that ball wasn't caught. That ball was caught. And he made a football move. That's another one of their stupid little terms in their vernacular. He made a football move by, while on his knee, reaching to extend the ball across the goal line to score a touchdown.
Which, of course, we know you can do when you haven't been touched yet. Knee wasn't touched yet.
So that in and of itself is a football move. And then it crosses the plane of the goal line. And so it's a touchdown. So, Jim, you can respond to that first, but then I want to get to my second point on this, that even if the rule is as lame and terrible as it is, I still don't believe it was applied right, and I'll tell you why after you respond.
Yeah, I'm looking at this. I even have the video up again on my end because I want to make sure I'm seeing everything right. And you know, for me, the biggest takeaway is, oh, goody, now we all have a new stupid term, did not survive the ground. I when I first heard it last night, I about fell over my chair thinking, oh, my, what are you talking about?
And if he said, anything, by the way, in his statement to the press pool after the game, did the official, that is what officials call it.
Okay.
After catch, you have to survive the ground. He said it's not, he didn't make it up. Well, it's part of their vernacular.
Fair enough, whatever. But I'm looking at this again and again in the slow-mo. And since he wasn't touched, he moved over to get, you know, cross that plane, regardless of our, you know, thoughts on the plane concept. And if anything, the way his one arm, I believe his left arm, you know, hits the ground, if anything, that's a ground-causing fumble, and I thought a ground couldn't cause a fumble.
That's
if
right.
anything,
that's
where
true
he
too.
Bobbled it, right at the end, right after his one arm hits the ground, that's when the ball bobbles, which is the part where the replay officials say, no, you actually did not survive the ground. So which is it, guys? Do you have to survive the ground, or can suddenly ground cause fumbles now? And even if it was a ground-causing fumble, he still fell on top of it in the end zone before somebody touched him. It still should have been a touchdown.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't even have to fall on top of it.
Right.
Because it was just still in his hands.
Exactly.
He just had to, you know, re-grab it. Those are very good points, but here's the other point that I wanted to make that I don't think I've heard anybody in national or local media talk about yet. And that is, let's just say for the moment that the rule is it exists, which it does, and it's right. And
okay.
That the official's job must be to call it an incomplete pass if that ball comes loose as he goes to the ground. Can anybody say to me that there was indisputable video evidence that he ever let the ball touch the ground during that moment? It clearly touches the ground after he secures it and the arms are thrown up. But when, and I'm watching it in a loop in front of me right now as well, his right hand and his left hand are in full control as he reaches into the end zone. And his left elbow touches in the end zone, by the way, with the ball out in front of it, in front of him, you know, in his left hand.
Yeah, about his elbow up was across the supposed plane.
Correct. It's over the goal line. In fact, his elbow lands on the stripe, so he's clearly well across the plane. And that's what forces his left hand to come off of the ball from the palm side, and he's actually pressing the football with the back of his hand into his right hand, which looks to me like it is absolutely under the football. So if the football is on his right hand, which is under the ball, and his left hand is pressing it against his right hand with the back of his, you know, left hand,
right,
he is still in control of the ball in the end zone without the ball being on the ground.
You're right.
Now, to be truthful, I can't quite tell if his right hand is fully under the ball, or if there's a part of the ball that might be on the turf. Might be. Which means what? That it's a touchdown. Because if I can't quite tell whether or not that ball is fully on his hand and therefore not touching the grass or the turf, then it's not able to be overturned. You only overturn overturn calls with clear, indisputable evidence that the call on the field was wrong.
And that's why when you hear an official after a review, that's why it's always important to make the notation. Does the call, you know, stand, or if it's confirmed, stand, call stands mean we don't have enough evidence.
We don't have indisputable evidence to prove that it was wrong. Exactly. So that's the part of this nobody is talking about, with this slight exception, I will say this, of Alex Kirshner on SB Nation. He is the only other person besides me, and I found this about a half an hour before we went on the air, just to see if anybody is talking about the actual catch itself. Forget about the rule, which we all hate, and that I think is going to drive more fans away. But just the fact that when he crossed the goal line with crossing the plane and then landed and the ball jarred loose from his left hand, does that mean that it touched the ground? Because the answer to me is no, not clearly. His right hand is under the ground, under the ball, and is, you know, the back of his right hand is on the ground, his palm has the ball, and his left hand is pressing the ball with the back of his hand because it got jarred from when his elbow struck. So as far as I can tell, in looking at it over and over and over again from multiple angles on a loop, there is no clear, incontrovertible evidence or indisputable evidence that the ball ever was on the ground and not in his possession before the touchdown was established. So I just think the officials butchered it six different ways from Sunday, and the fact that, like I said before, and Ryan Clark said it best too there, if it's a touchdown or and a catch to the fans in the bar, if it's a touchdown and a catch to the fans on a flag football field, then it's a touchdown.
Yep.
Stop telling the fans that they're stupid, too stupid to know exactly what a catch is. And I think it's going to come back to really hurt them. Because I will tell you, Jim, every time I see one of these, like the Dez Bryant play, every time I see one of these, like Calvin's original play, it makes me lose interest in the league. It just really does if they're not going to be reasonable and upfront and honest about it.
And the strange side note real quick to this, because of that ending and that call, it completely is overshadowing the fact that the Steelers are in trouble because Antonio Brown is gone.
He says, by the way, Antonio Brown, I'm glad you brought that up. Antonio Brown said it's just a minor setback. He said he will be back for the playoffs.
Still, that's a big loss for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, he will not win the MVP now, obviously, because he's not going to be able to add to those incredible statistics of his. But he will be back for the playoffs, which is the most important thing for the Steelers, obviously. So, all right, that music came way too fast. I wanted to talk more about that and also about the Dallas and Oakland call. But we'll have to do that the next time. And that next time, fortunately, is tomorrow, 3 o'clock, back again for another extravaganza. But stay where you are now. No reason to leave because Drive Time is coming your way right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We'll see you.